Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
I am very pleased to have a resident physician at Johns Hopkins with us this morning, Dr. Caleb Leiby, who has been kind enough to block out some time this morning after working all week on this issue to talk through what we're dealing with. And Caleb, Dr. Leiby, I'll start by making sure I give your credentials so everybody knows that this is...
No, that's just fine. I'm used to hearing Caleb.
Yeah. I watched the video that you did, what was that, about a week ago?
Yes, sir. Yeah, it was a week ago. Yep.
A week ago where you... It wasn't like you poo-pooed this. You weren't putting it down, but you tried to put it in perspective for people. And it jived with some of the other things that I've been hearing. And having been in the media for a long time, I know that reporters just instinctively like to go with people who are inflammatory because it makes for a better story. And, you know, here we are on this Friday after a full week of dealing with this domestically with some sort of intensity. What's your take on what is happening and the threat to the average person in the United States?
That's great. So I think that the largest problem everyone's having with this is the kind of data that we're getting about this. You know, people aren't sure what to do with the data because it's coming at them from an odd collection rather than a controlled environment where we know that, okay, this is slowly going up and we're getting all the right numbers from the right hospitals and all the doctor's offices. We've been very limited to knowing about this just based on who got tests and where the tests were sent and how many tests were actually out there. So I really think the numbers that we're seeing are pretty related to how many tests are being distributed, right? Because that's our only access to this data. So since last week, you know, when I think I made this video, I think I said something like it was like around 140,000 cases at that time. And, you know, obviously the numbers have changed since then. And I think, let's see, as of this morning, it was 245. Thank you. I was going to say like almost getting up to 250. Right. So, you know, the numbers have jumped, obviously. And the thing is that we do see this curve that does look pretty logarithmic, like it's a real exponential curve. So some of those things, it might be that we're getting a number of tests out just as quickly as, you know, the cases are rising. But there is that confounding variable that we're limited by the number of tests. So I think the main point of my video and the thing that I'll keep standing by is that it's hard to actually get a grasp on what's happening when we have limited ways of getting our information.
When you look at this situation with the Wuhan coronavirus and you look at other contagious diseases, the regular flu, and the number of Americans at any given year who are infected and suffer on some level through that process, is this comparable, or does this blow it out of the water, or are we below, based on what we know right now, this is kind of below that health problem?
I think the short answer would be that it is, we believe, and from the information that we have, which again is quite limited, that it will blow it out of the water because of the one main factor, and that is the infective rate, which we also call like R naught, which is probably being thrown out there a lot. But it does appear that this virus is a lot more infective, or the virility of it is quite stronger than the common influenza or influenza A or B that we see in the seasonal flu every year.
So that's an important
distinction.
A number that gets
thrown around is R naught, and I'm not sure if many people are familiar with that, but it's basically how many people you infect if you're sick, right? And so this one's 2.2 is what we think it is so far, but again, this is with the information that we have. whereas the flu is 1.5. So you can imagine that in an exponential growth, that makes a big difference.
So that's a really important distinction to make, that if you get it and you stay active in public, it right. is more likely that you will infect other people than, say, if back in January I had had the flu and came to the radio station and just kind of self-isolated, it would be less likely that I'd infect my coworkers.
Precisely. Okay. And you can imagine that kind of the selective pressure that's pushing maybe the influenza R-naught or that infectivity rate down is multiple things, that some of us have immunity, right? This has been around a while. And some of us have the vaccine, which, although not very effective compared to the vaccines for other diseases, it's still this year was something like 52 to 59% effective. So mm-hmm. that right there, you know, pushes math and pushes numbers down well enough that gives you that low R naught or 1.5 infectivity rate versus this one being up to 2.2, which, you know, the exponential math of that really is quite different.
Yeah. Here's the other question I think is key to our freak out factor or calm, stoic assessment of what's going on and the way we live our lives. I have been saying for weeks, and it's not just me making it up, it's based on watching people like you and talking to doctors on the ground here in Virginia, that this is not like Ebola. It's not like HIV right. in 1988, right. where you get it and the clock starts towards your
exactly.
demise. Am I correct in saying that, or am I being...
No, you are absolutely correct in saying that. So, and there again, to kind of put it in diseases, actually, I have it pulled up right now. So CDC published in a journal here just recently a pretty good chart talking about the ICU admissions versus case fatality, which kind of, you know, is one way to look at how serious the disease is, right? And so just looking over this list right now, you know, they have it in each age group. But, you know, for the, you know, I don't know what the demographic of most of your listeners are, but ages 20 to 44, and this is just looking at U.S. data, right?
Okay.
Because some of the other countries' data is tough. But just in the U.S., what we've got so far, ages 20 to 44, the case fatality rate is 0.1 to 0.2. This is still higher than influenza, and obviously strikingly higher than our day-to-day mortality rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is for sick people, and 0.1 to 0.2 usually isn't a number that would scare someone, right? And then, but then
it is
you
not,
know, obviously,
it is not a number that would normally scare people.
Right, right.
Okay.
And then you jump up to people 75 to 84, and you're already up to 4.3 to 10.5. So you're already getting to numbers that are pretty scary, and people usually wouldn't want to play those odds in Russian roulette. And
yeah.
then the big numbers happen over 85, where you can be all the way up to 27%. And so that's obviously where it makes big changes. But those numbers aren't that far off influenza,
yeah.
You know, by the time you get up to that age.
Yeah. So that's why our admonishment for the last couple of weeks, if you are a senior or you know you've got a compromised immune system, you really, all hype aside, you do need to self-isolate. Stay the heck away from people. That's
without a doubt.
Still. Now, I've seen a bunch of stories in the last couple of days, and I, again, having been a journalist, I am skeptical of these stories, but they to me, it appears that they're hyping, oh, this 30-year-old person died, and then we find out that they had something else that was wrong. A 21-year-old soccer coach in Italy died. We find out
right.
he had leukemia. You know, that's not in the initial headline, and the initial headline would scare the heck out of anybody with a young person in their life. Is it still accurate to say, based on what you're seeing firsthand and that data, that people in that younger age range are going to suffer if they get this, like a comparable to a normal flu, and then will rapidly recover?
I think from the information that we have that you can say that's absolutely accurate, that for the most part, this is going to be an upper respiratory illness that is quite mild for the healthy person.
Mm-hmm.
We have these outlying stories that obviously make a quite emotional pull. But, you know, as a healthcare worker that works with very sick people, I personally have watched young people die from the influenza just this year, you know, and all my coworkers have. So
because the pneumonia gets in their lungs and they suffocate, is that?
That's what it is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we've seen people that, you know, not only does it get in their lungs, but it decreases the defenses, right? So they're all used up for the flu, and then the bacteria or something else sets in. Often it's the after effect and the second infection that is superimposed on it that really knocks you down.
Gotcha.
And this, I'm sure, is what's going to happen here as well, that you're going to have secondary infections and other things come along while you're down, and that can knock you to that place of a high mortality rate.
We're talking to Dr. Caleb Leiby from Johns Hopkins, where they've done remarkable work of collecting the data, and they are treating patients who are dealing with the Wuhan coronavirus. In preparation at my house, and knowing how I have had to deal with sickness in the past and knowing my own vulnerabilities, I went and stocked up on the normal medicines that I would have if I got the flu, just in case somehow I get this. I bought pills to rehydrate me, you know, like you would if you had had a bender and you were hungover, you know?
Exactly.
Is that one of the issues here, too, for people who are outside of the 70, 80, 90-year-old category, is to make sure you're hydrated? Is that the other vulnerability besides the infection issue?
Yeah. No, I couldn't stress that enough. Just making sure that you're in the optimal state of health to handle the onslaught. Is really the very best that we can do as far as protecting ourselves once we get sick. However, obviously, the number one thing we can do is just not get it in the first place, not putting ourselves in a position to be exposed. And, you know, the two main things that a virus needs, very unlike bacteria or a parasite or something else that might love to live in the dirt or anywhere, is a virus does have to have a host. So this is why the stress of that being a social disease is so important, that this is not going to move unless it moves on a human being. So therefore, that's probably your greatest defense of all is not, first of all, not get it. And, you know, the only place to get it is other people.
Yeah. I asked our audience to go to the John Reed Show Facebook page to send some questions. And a few people asked whether the warming temperatures, it's going to be 85 degrees here in Richmond today, does that help us?
I wish I was down there.
Yeah. Does that burn off or kill the virus if it's in an exposed public place? And that may seem like a stupid question. But what do you think?
No, it's a pretty interesting question. And one I actually kind of like because, you know, the prospect of warmer weather, staving off, you know, some deadly pandemics, pretty enticing. And honestly, you know, viruses and influenza, like even things like the common cold, do subside in warmer. So I can see how for most people there's like this seasonability thing that makes it seem very scientific. Mm-hmm. And there is some scientific backing to this, but it might not be what people think. So to fully understand it, I might have to drop a couple scientific facts about a virus, and I hope it's not too early to dive into that.
You know what? Do you mind holding on for a minute?
I absolutely don't.
Yeah, hold on. Let's take a quick break, and then I'm going to call an audible here and kill a couple of other things that we would normally do, and then I'd like to continue the conversation. I feel like this is a real opportunity for us to talk to somebody on the front lines, and I don't want to miss that. Stay with us here on News Radio WRVA. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Well, that was a marathon of commercials, wasn't it? All right, sorry about that. 7:52 on this Friday morning. I'm John Reed. You're listening to News Radio WRVA, and we're talking to Dr. Caleb Leiby from Johns Hopkins, resident physician there, where they've been keeping a good track of all the data here. And you were just explaining to me about the warming temperatures. A lot of people are kind of hopeful that now we're headed into the warming temperatures, that this might help us and kill this virus and not make it spread as easily. What do you think?
So there's actually some scientific backing of that, because we do see that other viruses, and even the common cold or influenza, go down when it's not cold outside.
Right.
So they're actually, that's been studied pretty extensively, and yet you have to know that the viruses, such as coronavirus, are actually pretty similar to influenza in that they are in the same category of what we call enveloped viruses. So it's a virus that's got this envelope around it, and so therefore their behavior is actually pretty similar. So I think we can draw some information off of what we already very well know from influenza. And so the bottom line is that the reason why things decline in warmer weathers is that if they're spread via respiratory droplets, like this one actually is, then they're going to linger in the air for a little bit, and that's the moment and the time that's going to really contribute to how infectious they are. So you can imagine that in cold and dry weather, a particle can stay in the air for quite a bit longer, right? So it's lighter, it's going to stay there, and it isn't going to drop down. However, once it gets humid and warm, often these respiratory droplets drop faster and aren't held in the air, don't travel quite as far. So that right there was a study that really makes a lot of sense for why northern dry, cold areas spread the influenza a lot more in the winter.
Gotcha.
So in that sense, I think, we have the advantage this time that as far as warmer, humid weather can decline the virus. However, that's not the only factor in virus spreading or the virility of a virus, as we talked about before. It's also human behavior. So the two main factors on how a virus spread is, its makeup and what it can stand up against, and then how the humans or the hosts that it relies on behave. And so, unfortunately, the big thing is that the nicer weather might bring people out and might bring people together more, and therefore, that could all but do away from the disadvantage of the weather for the virus.
Gotcha. It struck me that the flowers are blooming here. What are the symptoms? And we're running out of time here, but real quick, what are the symptoms that distinguish this infection with the coronavirus from allergies or a common cold? Is there anything that you would, since you're a doctor and you're seeing these patients come in and you know what it looks like, before, if I'm trying to self diagnose what I've got, is there anything that tells me, hey, John, don't freak out, you probably don't have it, or versus, yeah, you probably need to call your doctor?
I wouldn't want to, because we haven't seen enough to make a big statement. I wouldn't want to put a statement out there that really makes someone think I shouldn't be worried. Mm-hmm. However, I will say this, that from what I've seen on the patients that I've seen and that, we know, this is a upper respiratory illness. So this is something that a lot of people are feeling, the cough and shortness of breath, a lot more than some of the other symptoms. So whereas the flu, most of the people that I see just feel like they've been run over by a truck. It's the myalgias, it's the aches. I haven't actually seen that. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but this does seem to be a lot more respiratory involved. So cough, shortness of breath seems to be a predominant factor, while the myalgias, aches, and fevers of the flu don't seem to be quite as involved. So that might be a little telltale sign that helps.
Good. Okay.
Thinking about this being upper respiratory.
And you know what? Let's try to stay in touch over the course of the next few days. I know you've been working long shifts, and I appreciate you coming off of the shift and talking to us this morning. Dr. Caleb Leiby at Johns Hopkins, a resident physician there. Appreciate it, and hope we'll talk to you again as we get more data and you see more people who hopefully get this and recover. You'll be able to offer some guidance there, too. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. I really
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.